Here's something new, something hot, something you haven't heard a lot. We know it's something you will like. It's the Yodel Polka. You don't need a saxophone, a clarinet, or slide trombone. Just clear your throat for a nice good tone and sing the Yodel Polka. Sing it day and sing it night. Sing it any time you like. It'll cheer you up, make things right. It's the Yodel Polka.
What's up, party people? This is Chris DeRose.
And this is John Seth.
And we're bringing you another special edition, which really isn't so special.
Not special anymore.
Yeah, they're not special anymore. Well, you know, I really like these conversations. We get to know people in the business. And today we're bringing you the Organ of QWERTY.
Which is your thing.
What's his name? Andy what? What's his name again?
Andy Grail?
Something like that. No, he's in the intro here.
Gale.
Yeah. And
Andy Gale?
When's the first time you saw him come out?
Oh, man, I don't know.
As like a person and not a robot?
I don't think I've ever seen him in person. Although I don't like watch a ton of Bitcoin interviews here and there. So like, yeah, I'm sure he does.
The audience doesn't get to see what he looks like, which I was shocked at how reasonable looking he was. I thought he had a shirt. He thought for sure he'd have like a mohawk and like piercings and tattoos on his face.
I would not be surprised if he was actually wearing pants during this interview.
No. No one's ever done that before.
I think he was probably wearing pants during the interview.
Oh, boy. Is he a Bitcoin professional?
Yeah.
Do we find one finally?
Him and Bruce Fenton.
I like this guy. I don't want to put him in the category of Bruce Fenton.
No, I didn't want to put him there.
Yeah. Well, we're not going to do our normal bantering Josh and I this week, in part because it's already Monday, we haven't recorded it yet, despite having like 10 pages of notes for last week, by the way.
Next year will be a 14-hour episode for next week.
but bear with us because we have an amazing episode coming up. We should have it probably next weekend or so. Let's see how things go. It'll be a little late, I think. There's a lot going on. I don't know if I can pull this off. There's a lot of moving wheels. And we don't want to say what's going on, but we've got a very special guest at the least. I can put it that way.
Hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah.
So
the other thing, we're strongly considering, Chris and I, moving the show and becoming cam girls. So we've been thinking about becoming cam girls. We're talking about it right now. It's in debates. We'll let you know.
Yeah, would you tip us in Bitcoin to see us in our underwear? If so, leave your comments below. We'd love to see how much that's worth.
Yeah.
There's a right answer here, and that's zero. you think we should do a video for next weekend instead of just like the normal audio?
A video?
Like
a video actually would be a really good idea.
Like, when's the last we've done a Chris DeRose movie?
Oh, man. The Bowl?
No, we did one after. We did the Bowl. We did the Hackathon. What else did we do? There's a few big ones we're missing.
One more after that.
We tried to do the Dope Movie, but that didn't pull
off.
Which
one?
Remember we went to see the Dope Movie?
Oh, yeah. That was good.
Some of the best footage that we could ever air.
Oh, man.
That would have been wonderful. Yeah.
That was my fault. I'm sorry.
There's been a couple more movies. I might not remember. Anyways.
Movies. Oh, there was the spaceship launch with Art.
Oh, that was a good one.
That was good.
Yeah. Was there a conference or two? Maybe not.
I'm sure there's plenty of conferences.
In any case, I think we're going to do a video. Let's just do
American
a video.
Banker.
Let's do it right next week's episode. We're going to make people watch it on YouTube.
We'll put the audio here, Chris DeRose style. Right? We could put the audio down.
I don't know, dude. Well, it won't be as funny. I know. I want them to go. Yeah, it won't be as funny. I want them to just go watch the video.
That's not a bad point.
And who knows? Maybe we'll do both even. Let's see.
All right.
Well, let's get this interview started with Organ of QWERTY, and hopefully you'll like it, and want to hear some more interviews. We've got a bunch of people lined up for guests, so let's see how many.
I can't believe we're doing so many interviews these days.
I can't either.
Yeah.
All right. Here goes.
So we have with us today Andy Gale, who's better known as Organ of QWERTY, or who runs the Organ of QWERTY blog, one of the probably most important blogs in the Bitcoin space. So we have him on today, and we're pretty excited because it's taken us a long time to coordinate this. And Andy, we're really honored to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
So do you want to? You're telling us a little bit earlier, like about sort of your coming out. So how did you? You were a little bit more anonymous before, and now you're, you know, not so much, but you're also not that public. So do you want to talk a little bit about your coming to Bitcoin, your decision to kind of become a more public person, and even maybe like a little bit about like how you started the blog?
Sure. Okay. Just a second. I just might move this for a tick. That's better. Yeah, I started just as another member of Bitcoin Talk. I started off mining Bitcoin in February 2011, and it was a bit of a mystery to me because I didn't really understand what I was doing. I was just after that magic internet money, and then when I understood what I was doing and what was happening behind the scenes, then it became really fascinating. That's when I started to get very interested in it. I started by investigating how one could exploit some of the reward methods in Bitcoin mining, the proportional reward method. And I did some posts on Bitcoin Talk about that. And then I did my first big post was on a forum called Hopper's Den, which is not around anymore. And it was about the reward method of BitClockers, which is also another pool not around anymore, and how BitClockers were not really rewarding their miners. That was probably my first big interesting post. And then from there, once I realized that there was statistical analysis I could do that other people couldn't, that sort of became one of the things that I found interesting to do.
So are you a programmer? What's your background? What allowed you to kind of do mining and figure mining out? I mean, mining isn't uncomplex, and understanding it to the degree that you understand it is something that's pretty rare. So do you want to talk a little bit about, what your background is in mining specifically? Your stats are wonderful as well. Like your blog has always reminded me a little bit of like TV Newser in the early days, which was just posting basically ratings every night. That was all it did, but that was information that was hard to access, except for the fact that TV Newser did it. So you kind of do that same thing with mining pools, who's mining what blocks, et cetera, et cetera. So it's very simple information, but it's very valuable information. So do you want to talk a little bit about that? How you started doing that? Why you started doing that? Why you find that information useful?
You're right. It is simple information, but it's hard to do well, and nobody really was doing it well. Blockchain.info is a very important part of the information that's available to anybody who's interested in Bitcoin, but some of the ways that they approach data collection and presentation is just not the way that I would do it, and I think can be a bit misleading. So I started to do weekly posts to try and give an alternative source of statistical data. I come from a statistical, the knowledge behind what I do comes from statistics that I've needed for work. I'm an audiologist. I work at Sydney Children's Hospital, and sometimes we need to use stats to analyze work that we've done, and that's where this sort of knowledge came from.
You probably would have been my doctor as a kid. I had tubes seven times.
Seven times?
Seven times.
I could have been the guy that tested your hearing.
Well, that's interesting, though. That's not at all what I would have expected from you. I would have thought you would have been probably in the, IT industry, programming large systems or something like that for some time prior. What got you into Bitcoin exactly? Did you just find it a curiosity one night?
Well, computers are certainly a hobby of mine. And one podcast that I'm a fan of is Steve Gibson's This Week in Security. And he covered Bitcoin in, I think, February 2011. And just the whole idea of it fascinated at that point. So, and then, you know, Bitcoin mining, it's tricky, but it's not impossible if you're really interested in it. You want to make it work and you've got some, you don't have kids, then it's certainly possible.
So why do you say you can't have kids?
Well, you could, but it just, it takes a lot of time. So it's the sort of time that if you had kids, you'd be spending on kids instead of on computers.
So
it takes up a lot of spare time. It takes up more spare time than if you had a hobby.
So are you very active then in Bitcoin monitoring at this point? Is that something that just runs on the side? Are you a passionate Bitcoiner these days?
In Bitcoin mining, no. Bitcoin mining now, look, a lot of the interesting problems are solved Reward methods, for example, that was the thing that got me into mining. And really, there's just, I think one pool still does EGM. Otherwise, it's PPL and, you know, pay per last end share or pay per share. And so I'm sure there's going to be some interesting ideas in this space, but they're not based on how fair the reward method is, which is certainly amenable analysis. Whereas going forward, I think you're looking at things like multi-pool insurance, Tony Rosenthal put forward, so that miners can get pay per share and the pools don't have to worry about risk exposure so much.
So you would normalize risk across pools at that point, right? Is that the idea?
Yeah, it's a little bit more complicated than that, and I haven't read his ideas for a while, but that's the way I would be suggesting that it goes, yeah.
Can you give us, I mean, this is a little bit of a tangent, but like, there's a lot of people that are kind of new to Bitcoin. And you've been in for a very long time, and you've been into one of the more interesting aspects of it. Can you kind of give us a brief history of mining? Just a little bit of like where it was, kind of where it's come, and like what's interesting about it to you today, you know, because there's been a lot of innovation there, like P2Pool and other such things. So kind of talk a little bit about that if you could.
Yeah. Well, keeping in mind, I have only been mining since 2011, but I have only done a bit of reading about what went on before me.
Right.
And also a bit of analysis of some of the blocks that had occurred early on to try and determine perhaps who created them. So we know that Satoshi was mining a large number of blocks, the majority of blocks, for a good part of 2009, and then he seemed to step his hash rate down suddenly to a certain level, and then stepped down again, and then by early 2010 it stopped mining altogether. At that point it was still CPU mining. Then about mid-2010 GPU mining was introduced, and that allowed order of magnitude change in hash rate. So a combination of GPU mining being available, the opening of Mt. Gox, and what's the other thing? Being slash dotted, all about the same time.
That's when I got in.
July, I think, 2010. And then within about a week or two, the network went up about the mining difficulty, the network size went up, I think, 400 or 800 just in that short period of time. So you see this big discontinuous jump about then.
And GPU mining was that introduced by Laszlo?
Sorry, what's that?
Was GPU mining introduced by Laszlo, the pizza buyer?
I'm not sure if it was him. I've heard that it was Artfors, the guy who did a GPU farm, to which was attributed a lot of that increase in hash rate in July.
There are emails between Satoshi
sure
and Laszlo.
Exactly who developed the first miner. I thought it was Artfors, but it could be.
I think it's Laszlo. I really do, because there's emails I've seen between him and Satoshi where they discuss, and I think Satoshi asked him maybe to delay his turning on.
Well, I know that
GPUs.
Satoshi asked him to not
to wait a little while.
The hash
yeah.
rate so much, but I mean those early days are interesting because there's a lot of like sort of altruistic control that people are exercising, even compassion in the early days of mining, I think, which is really interesting, which is not the case now.
No, not at all. But then again, that's really what Satoshi was aiming at. He wanted a system where miners mined for selfish reasons, where you could actually use the system and be selfish, and the system would still prosper. That's I think you have to assume that in any system like that, people will act for selfish reasons. I think he did his best to design so that would help the system propagate, the network propagate, and grow stronger if people did act in their own best interest. But yeah, in early days, everyone was trying to help everyone else. Some of that still exists today. You go onto the pools support of Bitcoin Talk. People are helping each other out. They're also taking the piss as well, but you know, they spend a bit of time helping each other out.
Do you know what kind of resources Satoshi was putting into the network in the old days? Do you think it was just a couple of desktop computers, or do you think it was actually a substantial amount of energy back then?
Oh, we can measure. I don't have the figures on hand, but we can measure exactly what Satoshi's hash rate was and what the network hash rate was. I think it was the equivalent of 2 or 3 desktop computers, but it could have been, if there was some cloud computing, he could have used computing at that point, which sort of would make, I guess, you know, if he was paying for, you know, an Amazon instance or whatever was available in 2009, then you know, he just buys a few of them and then cuts one of them off and then cuts another one of them off. That might explain the discontinuous drops in hash rate from Satoshi. So I'd say it was probably cloud-based computing at about 3 computers worth initially of cloud-based computing.
Do we know if any of the coins have moved whatsoever from those pools? Like even a single one of them have ever moved? Is that certainly not the case, other than the ones he's given out by email, or do we don't really know that information?
Sorry, I missed the start of that.
How much do we know about the coins that Satoshi spent? Do we know that like the vast majority of them have not been transferred other than to people on the mailing lists? Or do we not really have a good idea?
We've got a reasonable idea of which coins were mined by Satoshi based on certain things about the certain properties of the block that were mined at that point. And then if we assume that those are Satoshi's blocks, then we can follow the coins and see if they've gone anywhere. So from what I can see, the ones that we're certain are haven't really moved, except when, you know, when he was attempting transactions in the early days.
So you want to skip ahead to the present day maybe and talk about some things that even I would like to know,
sure,
questions
yeah.
that I have.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, so what do you think about the geographic allegations that the miners are all concentrated in China or Estonia? What do you think about those allegations? Do you think that there's a lot of truth to that? And do you know what components do you think
is there
are
evidence?
In what country? Yeah. What? How much do we know about those claims?
So when you say miners, do you mean the guys actually with equipment in their homes or the actual guys making the block?
I think we'd like to know both, because I think there's a difference between decision makers and those who hold the actual equipment, right?
Yeah. So I think that, a majority of the network hash rate is introduced to the network, the block made in China at the moment. As to whether a majority of miners actually live there, I don't know. I don't know that it's easy to tell for certain. You have to go by what it says on, say, AntPool's website. I think they claim about 90-odd% of their miners are Chinese, which would make a lot of the network miners Chinese. Unfortunately, not many pools actually publish anonymized data about their miners. The few that I've got, it's quite useful, but it's maybe only about 8 or 9% of the network, or 8 or 9% of mining pool, of the network of mining pools, if you like, that I have data for. So I don't like to extrapolate that out to the entire network. At one point, I had something like 40 or 50% of the network information about those miners, and then I could extrapolate out to the rest of the network quite well. At that time, we had about 100,000 miners. If, say, 50% of the network is Chinese and 90% of those are actual Chinese miners, then you know, maybe 40% of the network are Chinese miners, guys who have mining equipment in their home.
So one of the questions I have about Chinese mining is that I look at, like, charts of node counts in places. Like, I don't know how accurate those are, but one of the things I notice is that in China there seems to be very few nodes.
Very few nodes.
Yeah,
I don't know. I don't know if that's as a result of the firewall, the Great Firewall of China, make it difficult for people to have nodes, or just a lack of interest in having their own node. Where there might be some economic reasons.
What would make me wonder, though, is if you're mining in China, if a majority of mining is concentrated there, why would you have so few nodes? And does that mean that there's a lot of miners who are doing like SPV mining or something like that? Like that seems to me to be a big kind of concern, and probably means that either the claims about China and mining are a little bit specious, or that these node broadcasts are a little bit wrong.
So what do you mean about the claims of China and mining?
Just that it's as big as it is. I would think that if you're mining, you would want to be running full nodes.
I've heard that these miners have high bandwidth links themselves to other continents. I don't know if that's true. So yeah, tell us, what do you know about that?
Well, look, the guys who actually do mining, the guys who have equipment at home, don't need to have a local client, don't need to keep their own node. It's only the guys who actually make the block who send, if we separate them into block makers and miners, say.
Right. So hash contributors.
The actual hashing.
Yeah.
And the block makers, the guys who actually make the blocks, then the guys who do the hashing don't need a node. So, you don't need to have a bunch of nodes to make sure that the work that you do, the hashing work that you do, gets to make a block or gets you money from a pool. It's only the pools that need that, or solo miners, or P2 pool miners, if you like. But I think most Chinese miners, from what I've, the little bits that I've had and understood, mostly mine it at pools or are very, big solo miners. So I would say that the pools themselves probably use the mining backbone, Matt Corallo's link between a bunch of different miners to make sure that orphan races are reduced. And if they've got that, then having a whole lot of nodes is probably unnecessary, as long as they can link to outside of China and get their blocks propagated outside of China quickly. They don't really want to have some sort of partition happening where they propagate quickly in China and then find that because they haven't gotten outside of China to where the majority of nodes are, that they've lost the orphan race. They want to get outside that firewall as quickly as possible.
Do you maintain much contact with miners at all? Are you an island onto your organ, or are you very well networked in these communities?
Sorry, am I networked into
the mining community? Do you go out to many events? Do you talk to these people in side channels and such, or are you completely independent?
Are you
of
just looking at the data?
I mostly look at data. I've been to a few events, not many. Mostly the events here up until recently were mostly at pubs and clubs, and I just find it difficult to have a conversation when there's a bunch of other crap going on in the background, so that wasn't for me. Recently there's been some more serious efforts at putting on events, and I've gone to those and they've been quite interesting, but I haven't seem to connect better online, because I can get a better feel for what someone is after if I can read an email, and I can determine whether or not I want to collaborate with someone if I can read what their ideas are and whether they're serious or not. But I do all this after work, so I've got quite a limited amount of time I've got, and I really only want to work with people who are serious about what they do.
It seems like the most productive people in Bitcoin are people with jobs already who do Bitcoin as a hobby. But can you – so you were talking to us a little bit earlier about things that you really enjoy. One of the things you said is stuff that you don't understand, right? And you really like the way it sounds to me is you like to go around and collect puzzle pieces and then kind of put the puzzle together, right? Can you talk a little bit about, maybe some of the things that you're seeing in the data now that is different, that maybe you don't understand, that you're trying to understand, that you think is really interesting?
Sure. I did some posts on blockchain voting a while back. And one of the things that I hadn't managed to model is the distribution of how voting changes, the distribution of votes with respect to the actual underlying proportion of the network voting yes. And it's not very simple, and it's based on a random walk. And so it's something I just haven't been able to model yet, and that's what I'm finding interesting right now. That's what I'm working on at the moment. Rather than having to just simulate results, I'd like to be able to explain why these results are the way that they are.
What percentage of miners do you think are not identifying their mining? We've heard allegations that, like, Bitfury, for example, is participating anonymously on many pools. In addition to its own. Do you think there's a lot of validity to that? Do you think that's very common or not at all the case?
Do you think there's a chance that they have more than 50% of the mining?
Oh, I see. I don't know. George from Bitfury is absolutely proud of every single time that their hash rate goes up. He'll say something on Twitter about it. And usually, even before their hash rate goes up, he'll post something on Twitter saying, oh, look at our hash rate. It'll be increasing in the near future. So to have a certain amount of their hash rate go dark, I find that, well, especially if it was up to 50% of the network, I think he'd be proclaiming that proudly. I don't think there's much of a chance that he'd be spreading it amongst pools. Besides which, he'd be sending a big proportion of it to competition like Antpool. And I don't think he'd be wanting to do that, because Antpool also has of private mining that the pool does itself. It's not just a public pool, it has a certain amount of private mining that it does. It's possible, but I'm not seeing a great deal of evidence from pools that I can monitor.
What do you think the seniorage rates are these days? Do you have any concept of that whatsoever for the industry, what they've been historically? Have you ever tried to figure that number out and figure out what the miners are making on an average annualized basis?
Firstly, you need to know how much of the network each miner has. And I did some analysis of that a few years ago. And that varies so much. It varies down from guys who are still to this day CPU mining, and guys who have, you know, a significant portion of the network mining at a pool. And because of that, taking average value is average value varies so much from day to day, depending on whether or not some really big miners might have bought. So it's really hard to figure out what an average value might be. What you can do is work out how much miners should earn as a fair amount per hash, and which areas of the world that should be profitable in. So it all comes down to, at the moment, whether or not you can mine for, whether you can pay, how little electricity you can pay, and that will determine how profitable you are.
Right, but I think that the question is, like, do you have any idea what that number actually is? Because it would seem to me that miners would generally concentrate in one geographic region because of subsidies and other such.
Also, the premium on fungible value.
Sure. Yeah.
Which in China right now is fairly high, but which is probably a lesser part of that equation, but that deserves to be noticed, because that's one of the reasons why the Venezuelans are mining.
That's absolutely true. So, I mean, like, yeah, there's a lot of people that are mining in order to export value from their country. So there's that. But those people, I think, are willing to take a reduction, right? So I guess our question is, what is the profit that miners are actually making? Because it can't be that much. As Hal Finney was once known to have said, the universe doesn't leave free money sitting out there on the table. So that's kind of what we've been trying to figure out, is what is it that the miners are actually making above what they're spending on electricity?
Yeah, I don't know. When there weren't that many types of mining equipment available, I also did some work on that for a while. But there's a bunch of different machines that can be on the network at once. It's hard to know what the average efficiency of each machine is, so it's hard to know what the average profit is overall. You could sort of work it out for each machine separately, and then say, well, these machines could be profitable in this area, but electricity is a bit more expensive here, so only this machine, the newest, the most efficient, could be used here. And then that changes. So I don't know. Unless you've actually got feedback from the industry and a list of how many machines have been sold and how long you think how long they think those machines will last for. At this point, it's very hard to come up with a typical or average value.
Have you seen the Bitfury cargo containers that they're selling?
Yeah, I saw that on Twitter, and I had no idea of the scale. And they just mentioned, you know, it was a multi-petahash machine. And I thought, oh, cool, I might get one of those at home.
Well, you can get one, but if you have kids, you can't.
No. Or neighbors.
Yeah.
Or neighbors, exactly.
Yeah.
I feel like that'd be like a really loud substation. One of the one
please,
of the loudest.
The exhaust will probably heat your neighborhood. They just open their windows for heating that night.
It snowed here last year. What's going on?
Yeah, that you could probably just relocate to a desert somewhere and get a lot of solar power, and away you go.
Well, I asked Alex Petrov yesterday if I could get one for my backyard, and he asked me if I had what was like 150 megawatts of electricity or something like that connected to my house. I said, yes, of course. I just got a Tesla. Yeah. But yeah, to see that sort of thing being sold, it seems to me that mining has come a long way from where it was. So, where do you think mining is going to go from here? Like, we're putting miners in cargo containers now. So what's next? Like, what does the next step in mining look like, do you think?
Well, I think it's going to be a consistent increase in efficiency and hash rate. People will continue to make improvements in design. And if Bitcoin continues the way it's going, it may actually drive innovation in, you know, that particular space. And some of that will flow off to people who might want to do mining at home, because it seems that hobby miners are not mining necessarily rationally. They're not making a lot of money compared to the amount of time and effort that they put in and set electricity costs, but they enjoy it. It's kind of a fun hobby for them to have. So I think there's always going to be individual miners, but I think that it's going to, at the moment, more than about 60% of the network is contributed by individuals, private individuals. And
wow.
I'd say that's probably going to drop to about 40% of the network over the next couple of years.
That sounds pretty decentralized.
Do you have big fears about the centralization degree of the network currently? Is that something you worry about, or do you not worry about? Is it better now than it's been, or worse than it's ever been? What do you think about that allegation?
Yeah, it's not something I worry about. It's something that I monitor and something that I would bring up if I started to notice it get really bad. But we don't really even know, you know, we've got certain sorts of metrics that we can use to measure centralization of anything, not just Bitcoin mining. And we don't know what level of centralization is going to result in something bad for the network. We can generally say we don't like centralization, but we don't know what the limits are. You know, when something bad could happen, how much of the network, I mean, we know that if someone has 51% of the network, they could attack it if that's what they wanted to do. But are there other sorts of limits where you end up having cartel-like activity starting to occur? It's hard to say. So that's why I monitor centralization. I present the data, and I let people who know about it, more about economic activity comment on it, rather than having strong views myself. I'm willing to learn rather than to sort of talk out my butt.
we do our best to talk out our butts.
Yeah, but I wish other people had your attitude in this space.
It seems to me too, though, Andy, that you're distinguishing between hash contribution and block generation, right? Which I think is an important distinction. And can you talk about that? Because like the fact is, in my opinion, if you don't own your hashes, you don't own your hash rate, right? That's what I say a lot when people say that, like, the, you know, five most important people are on stage, they own 63% of the network. And I look, well, four of them are pool operators. Those guys are not really representing centralization at all. They're certainly making blocks, but they don't own their hash rate. So can you talk about, a little bit about like the distinguishing between like a block operator, a company like Bitfury, and maybe a pool, and the level of like centralization that both of those entities sort of represent?
I was reading a great post on Bitcoin Talk. I think it was from Greg Maxwell, who pointed out that if you're a public pool, then you've got a bunch of miners who can change their mind about whether or not to mine with you if you do something bad, like create blocks without transactions.
Or that.
I was just sort of explaining what empty blocks were and why they occurred.
Selfish mining.
No, he's saying it's different than selfish mining.
I thought selfish mining was not creating.
So selfish mining is a quite a complicated thing. I can send you a link on it, but it's got more to do with cartel mining than not creating blocks, not creating
blocks of transactions,
not putting transactions,
yeah,
blocks. The reason that some pools won't put transactions into blocks has more to do with not wanting to spend too much time on the block changeover, trying to figure out whether or not the previous block was valid and which transactions to put in it. If you don't check that a block's valid, then you can't put any transactions into the next block because you don't know which ones have already been included. So you could create a double spend. So the guys that don't validate the previous block can't put transactions into the next block. And that's why you get these empty blocks, because they don't want to miss out on a block for their miners by spending too much time validating the previous block.
So are they? So they're. Is it the case that they're spending time validating the previous block, and while they're validating, if they find the next block, then they don't include any transactions?
That's right.
Okay, interesting. I've never really understood that process, but that makes perfect sense. Which, by the way, sounds like it would be a bigger problem at 2 megabytes, right? If we were to increase the block size. I don't want to like make a block size debate, but that would be a more pronounced problem at 2 megabytes. At a 2 megabyte
block. That's right, yeah. If you've got a larger block, then it's going to take that much longer to validate it. And it's also going to take time to propagate it through the network if you're propagating the entire block. The larger the block, the longer the information is going to take to propagate through the network. And then validate.
But the over...
There are some ideas.
Sorry, keep going.
Sorry?
Keep going.
There are some ideas that people have. I don't think they're implemented yet about how to get the information propagating through the network more rapidly. But I'm not sure if there's anything that's aimed at reducing the time taken in validation. I mean, the time taken in validation, there has to be some time taken in validation because...
But if you're a miner, the time taken to validate is probably very low, because I would think you would have made the investment of some form of ASIC on your relay, either GPU or otherwise.
Oh, sure, but it does still take some seconds to do. If you look at pools like Kano's pool, for example. They actually don't do. I haven't seen any empty blocks. There might be one or two, but they've gotten their pool software to the point where they rarely ever need to create empty blocks. So the fact that some pools are regularly creating them, to me, tells me probably more about the state of their pool software than the fact that they want to do something bad, that they're being lazy, or that they want to create empty blocks. It just seems more like they need to work on their pool software a bit more.
who is making that pool software, by the way?
Well, I think Con Colavas is an Australian guy. He works in a hospital as well. He's an anesthetist, but he's DK at Bitcoin Talk. He and Kano do the most widely used mining software, DG Miner, and they also work on DK Pool. So those two things are some of the best known sorts of pool software and mining software around. And those guys have their own pools, and they seem to be very well operated pools as well. Canada School especially, is really starting to become very popular recently. Actually, now I've totally lost track of your question. Sorry.
Well, the question was, does a mining pool cause centralization?
Back to that. Sure. Sure. So because miners can move from pool to pool if they want, if the pool that they're at does something they don't like. For example, recently Slush's pool had an issue with an unintentional block withholding attack. And a lot of miners who didn't really know what was going on just moved from Slush's pool to a different pool. And the same sort of thing happened to a less extent when people realized how many empty blocks Antpool were creating. In my opinion, they're probably a little bit high. Having spoken with some of the guys from Antpool, I don't think they're trying to do it maliciously, create these empty transaction-free blocks. But still, a lot of miners left that pool and moved elsewhere. So if one pool seems to be getting too big, miners will move there to a different pool. So centralization, you know, public pools versus private pools, public pools will tend to have certain pressures on them to act a particular way. Private block makers have only pressures from their investors to make them act a particular way. And if for some reason they have to act in a way that's better for them short term and might be less good for Bitcoin long term, then they will act in a way that gives them the best short term return or the best return for their investors, because that's what they are there to do. They're there to give a return on their investors, not
to improve
Bitcoin work.
Yeah,
that's right.
So as I understand it, these pool operators can rob essentially from their pool with impunity by getting unlucky and submitting the block outside of their advertisement.
Well, without signing it as their block, right? Like,
correct. Is that true? Is that trivial, and is that done often?
It's possible. I've gotten to the point where I've got I think less than 1% of all blocks are unknown at the moment. Less than 1% are either signed or have a generation address that I can trace back to a particular entity. So if it's happening, it's happening at a very low level. And it will show up in the long term. Ghash had a really long-term vulnerability, which I warned them about at the beginning of last year, and kept emailing them and telling them there's something wrong with your luck, because, you know, they're quite transparent. They do publish all of their data, which you can then use to check to see if their luck is too low, if you like.
I like that. There's something wrong with your luck.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's so right. And I could tell them that, but they weren't listening until at some point they lost a lot of miners and decided to look into it, and they found that they'd had this vulnerability, which had been long-term, and they fixed it, and all of a sudden their luck went back up to normal. But now people, you know, that their name is synonymous with
this long vulnerability.
Unfairly, in my opinion, yeah, with being ripped off, because they didn't do this on purpose.
Are you sure of that? Do you really know that?
Look, if they were going to rip miners off, then either you would do it in a way that wouldn't be quite so noticeable, or you would just have an exit scam. So you just owe people a lot of money, keep owing them, and then just shut off all communication with them.
But the way
they've done it, and they're still around to this day trying desperately to get some miners back, I don't think they would have been.
What did you notice? So, like, the mining generally distributes you win blocks basically on a random walk, right? Like, we're talking random walks. Like, it is quasi-random, but it is also essentially normal, right? So over the long term with big numbers, you're going to be able to figure out, as you said, whether someone's luck is off, right?
Yeah, it's
so this must have been, like,
not normal, not quite a random walk, but there are ways that are like that to figure out a confidence interval,
sure,
for a certain amount of luck. So if a pool publishes that it took X share, you know, some number of shares to solve a block, you can compare that to what it should have taken which is the network difficulty. And depending on whether it's more of that, more than that or less than that, you can say whether the pool was unlucky or not. And you can also give confidence intervals for that luck, how unlucky they were.
So how unlucky was G hash show, like 0.25% below or something, like some tiny amount?
By the time the first time I contacted them, it was a 1 in 1,000 chance for them to have been that lucky over 1,000 blocks. And then by the time they, then I kept emailing them. By the time they actually admitted there was a problem, it was billions and billions and I couldn't get enough decimal places on my computer to figure out exactly how unlikely it was.
How much money did they lose? In Bitcoin.
If we go to my blog, because I don't know any of this stuff offhand, but
this is pretty interesting though.
Just go to my blog and have a look at.
Markets are so efficient sometimes.
It's so true. I mean, what would we have done without you, Andy? Yeah. Like, they would never have known it. They would have been sitting there like, what happened? Like, here they...
I don't know if they listened to anything that I had to say, to be honest.
But it sure makes them feel rotten, I bet. and it also makes them culpable, in my opinion.
Yeah, but more from incompetence rather than actual...
Malice,
I think.
I don't know that matters anymore. In Bitcoin, I've learned that they're the same thing.
I reckon they might have lost about 10%.
10%?
Wow. In the last year, they've mined 1,100 blocks, minus 29 for, so say 1,160 blocks. And so they probably lost around about, 100 250 blocks worth of coins in that time alone.
But that's just in the last year, and they're now down to what, 6%?
Yeah.
And at that time when you were pointing that vulnerability out, they were between 30% and 50% of the network.
They'd started to go down. Yeah, I think they're at about 30% already at that point. People had already noticed the luck. Look, if it gets to the point where I'm saying that there's a problem, then there's definitely a problem. People say there's luck problems at pools all the time. But until I've actually seen enough...
You're just calculating the score, right? You essentially say, well, 1 in 1,000 is pretty rare, and then 1 in 1,000,000 makes it certain.
It's got to hit certain confidence levels for me to say that it's bad. Oh, okay. Ghash is at 0.7% of the network now.
Yeah.
What did you do before Bitcoin? What did you analyze?
Were you just bored?
What did you do before Bitcoin?
That's a beautiful ear, sir.
Not an interesting story, but it's a story. I was doing marathon running and I blew up my calf and found myself laid up for a while.
Ah,
so, what a fortuitous accident for us. The Bitcoin had benefited from your loss.
That's true.
So let me ask you some questions about some of the other sides of this cryptocurrency movement. What do you think of the alt chains exactly? Is that even a little bit interesting to you or very or not at all?
I think it could be interesting. I was hoping what altcoins would be were alt chains as in Ethereum or alt coins.
Well, I mean, alt chains are what we generally call altcoins.
Yeah, altcoins.
Testnet scams.
I had to broaden the definition to include Hyperledger and these things.
Okay, I think that that something like Ethereum is very interesting, and I think there's certainly a place for it. And I'll be very interested to see where it goes. I think that altcoins could have been something much more interesting than what they've turned out to be, because I was hoping it would be sort of like a test bed, and that people would fiddle around with various values and come up with values that for example the block rate. Come up with values that were optimal, and they just keep trying and trying and trying until they had optimal everything. But really, it's just evolved into a bunch of scams to the greater part, for what I can see.
Yeah, they're testnet scams.
The only point that I've actually got any of is Clam Coin, and that's because
they gave it to you.
No, well, sort of, yeah, but you could have just sold it straight away. I put that into Just Dice, and because I the amount of data that you can get about Just Dice is, it lets you do some interesting analysis if you've got some spare time.
Right.
And, you know, if you're an investor, then it's still sort of gambling, but with positive EV. And so that's exactly the sort of gambling game for me, one that has a positive EV instead of a negative one.
Nice.
I'm kind of risk-averse.
Yeah, we're the same way. That's why we're all here at Bitcoin, because we're risk-averse.
Yeah.
And what do you think about these? Sorry.
Yeah, so altcoins, I really don't think have done what they could have done, what I'd hope they do, and that is to be a test bed for what changes could be made, useful changes could be made.
And it seems to me that they literally have become exactly that, though. Like they are test beds. The thing that it sounds like you didn't anticipate was they were also going to be religions. So they're like they're like test net religions.
Yeah, but they are in a way, because they're all trying all these different ways of, you know, trying different variables, trying different ways to make their coin. But it's just trying to make their coin different from another one, so that you don't have, so that
you can attract 16-year-old money.
Yeah, you need to have something to differentiate you in the market. So some of the variables that they change, they just change randomly, not because they think it will make their coin better, but because it will differentiate them in the marketplace.
Yeah, correct.
And what I hoped was it would be more of a, you know, survival of the fittest type thing, where some coin would come out above all the others because it had certain parameters that seemed to work best.
That's what's happened, though. It's Bitcoin.
Do you see?
That's what's happened. It's Bitcoin.
That is Bitcoin, because it already had it had so many people involved in it already.
Yeah.
But there are so many altcoins and so few people willing to spend time on them that none of them can really get much better than
others.
Because, as you say, people adopt a religious attitude towards them rather than a rational one.
The only reason to mine an altcoin is to sell your altcoin for Bitcoin. And that sort of effect also seems to be, creating these very scammy environments for these things. It seems to us that there's a sort of proof of work level comparison to the entire state of proof of work, where like the longest chain is the one that you want to join. And that being Bitcoin just happens to keep on bearing out even outside of the ecosystem of Bitcoin itself.
Right. I generally refer to altcoins as
out of consensus
Bitcoin forks.
Yes.
They're chains you shouldn't be working on.
Yeah. Well, chains that you shouldn't be working on if you want to make a valid method of transferring value. But if you're doing a test bed for something and you want to see if it works, and then maybe, you know, see if you can hard fork Bitcoin to use those parameters, then I think that's what the value of an altcoin is. None of the altcoins are different enough from Bitcoin, apart from Timecoin, which had some interesting ideas in it.
Time travel?
if you Google Timecoin, Timekoin, it isn't a proof of work coin or a proof of stake coin or a proof of any of that sort of cryptocurrency type thing. And it seems interesting, but I don't really know enough about it. But it's the only altcoin that I know of that is significantly different to Bitcoin and its daughter cryptocurrencies.
What do you think of merge mining? Do you understand merge mining?
Yeah, I do.
We do not. We can't get any explanation of it, so.
Do you want to explain it to us a little bit? Because we've had very weird conversations on merge mining, and I'd be curious to know what you think of it.
Okay. I obviously don't know about the mechanics of it because I don't program pool software. But each time, if you do merge mining, each time you create a valid Bitcoin block, you're also creating a valid merged mining coin block. Whatever, say for example, you're merge mining Namecoin and Bitcoin. Each each Bitcoin block you create, you also create a valid Namecoin block. You can mine Namecoins directly if you want, but each Bitcoin block is a valid Namecoin block. I don't know if it works in reverse. I doubt it.
Is it the same hash?
This is what I don't fully understand about merged mining. You would expect the hashes to be different because you couldn't include all the same transactions in a Namecoin block as a Bitcoin block. It simply is different work. Like, how do you get the same hash for a Namecoin block as for a Bitcoin block when the Namecoin block cannot include the same transactions as for a Bitcoin block? So, short answer there is I have no idea.
There's like three people who understood that problem. They solved it, and then they all can't explain it.
They all walked away. They don't know how it works now. The way that I've like tried to – I mean, I don't know if this is it, but I thought the way that it worked was in the course of hashing, if you find a valid hash for Namecoin or your merge mine chain, you could submit that as a valid hash for that chain, difficulty adjusting on that chain concomitantly. But I really don't know. I have no idea because I know the block propagation – the block propagation is, in fact, done by the miner who's hashing, which takes up bandwidth, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, what you're saying is correct. The hash that you create for Bitcoin, if you're merge mining, should be a valid hash for Namecoin.
Right.
But I don't know in the mechanics of that how that could possibly work, because if you change a transaction in the data that you're hashing, you change the hash completely. So if you've gotten some information from a pool about, data that you need to hash, I'm not quite sure how one hash can then be used by, the Bitcoin hash can be used by Namecoin, but it is.
What's the risk also in merge mining? Like, what's your vulnerability there? Is it in between Bitcoin blocks? If you fork, what happens? I've never gotten a sufficient explanation there either. Do you understand that end?
We do know there is risk, though.
Yeah. They're two totally different things, Bitcoin and, say, Namecoin. All you're doing is just – it just so happens that if you make a valid hash for one, you've got a valid hash for the other, and so you get one of each. Okay, so I think the risks are – the risks to the merge mined coin is that you're going to absolutely destroy its value, because you're going to have a lot of people and security. Not the security. You're going to improve the security, but you're going to have a lot of people that are creating Namecoin blocks and have no interest in Namecoin whatsoever. So you end up with, instead of people being able to choose one coin or the other, say, for example, for some reason, Namecoin's value had increased, well, you might see some miners go over to that for a while and then go back to Bitcoin. But when you're merge mining, you're just piggybacking on top of another block. You're putting every block creates 50 or 25 name coins, and they're coming out rapidly. And so if people don't want them, then the value of each name coin block drops.
Do you think Namecoin is a good idea, like any of these merge mined coins, or do you think eventually that will move on to Bitcoin? Like we've talked a lot about things that are on the Bitcoin blockchain. There's a lot of criticism about putting things on the chain itself, writing to it. Like Luke Dash Jr. talks about putting information into the blockchain that's non-transactionary as blockchain rape. So, I mean, what do you have to say about that? What's your personal opinion? I know that's not exactly what you blog about, but you've been around a while.
Yeah. I think it's a little bit funny coming from him, given the Coinbase signatures that he added at some point.
I think he regrets having done that.
Probably.
But of course, you can put all sorts of crap in the Coinbase without it affecting anything else would be his answer. That's really what the Coinbase is for. It's all graffiti. As for putting other stuff in there that's non-transactional, I'm kind of two minds about it. If people are willing to pay for it, then yes, I think it's okay. But,
you always have to pay for it though, don't you? Like, miners will only include it if it's paid for.
No. there's lots of free transactions that like transaction-free transactions that are getting.
Well, you got to pay $0 for a free transaction then. Like that. That's what, if the miners are taking those transactions, you know, that seems to me to be a problem of like miner software. Again, as you were saying about like about pool software.
I don't know. They do it on purpose because you know, if you don't include a transaction fee, then you will end up possibly waiting a while for your transaction to go through. But you don't have to pay for it. Once competition for block space increases, and people get used to paying a greater fee for faster processing, then perhaps this will be less of an issue. But right now, from what I can see, there's no transaction fee or no significant transaction fee market. I haven't been able to find a clear indication that transaction fees are generally increasing along with the block size or the number of transactions, which is a bit of a shame. Until they do, we'll find that just to make sure that they've got the biggest blocks possible, a lot of pools will simply include a lot of free transactions.
Interesting, yeah.
What do you think of proof of stake? Is that at all interesting to you?
Yeah, well, Clamcoin is proof of stake.
Oh, was it? I didn't know that.
It's now, right? It's interesting. It's a little less interesting because the idea of it is more of a it's a much more economic theory-based idea than Bitcoin is in a way. I understand it. I understand the idea of it. I understand the idea of why Bitcoin should work much better than why a proof of stake or proof of active stake type thing should work.
You and every other developer of proof of stake.
You have to consider that most of these stake chains are stake based because they realize that they're not going to get any miners on their chain. And so they start pursuing what we would advocate as perpetual motion because they see the battle to secure the faith of miners is inordinately difficult. We've seen that over and over and over again.
Well, that might be the case now, but the guys who actually, I remember reading about proof of stake, maybe it was 2012. The guys who advocated it didn't have that on their minds at all, trying to attract miners or anything like that. They just thought that this was a very interesting idea from an economic standpoint. So people might be using that now because they don't think they can attract, you know, miners away from either Bitcoin or Litecoin, you know. And also, don't forget that if you've got a coin that uses some sort of hashing algorithm that ASICs have been created for, then your coin is going to be annihilated out of the gate. People are just going to jump on it, increase the hash rate up until it's no longer profitable to mine that coin, and then they'll leave, and then all of a sudden it takes forever for your difficulty to drop back down again. And we see that a lot. So you can change hashing algorithms to something that ASICs haven't been created to do yet, but then you've got, you know, the problems with creating a whole, you know, security problems that will come when you change the security of a coin to something completely new. So I guess proof of stake removes all of that as an issue.
Andy, we don't want to keep you for too long, but as an Australian, I think everyone will be very curious about whether you knew the now infamous Craig Wright and what you thought of him.
Okay, I didn't know him personally, but I did attend an interesting talk by him at a conference a while back. And, you know, he didn't sort of stand out as a star talker on that particular day. There are lots of other way more interesting talks. But he had a doctorate, so I sort of tried to pay as much attention as I could. So when someone suggested that he might be Satoshi, regardless of whatever proof they had, I just couldn't see it as being accurate.
I think that doctorate has even been since called into question.
Yeah, you got you got scammed there, Andy.
He isn't what he was representing himself as. I didn't see any flashes of Einstein-like brilliance that I would expect to come from someone who was claiming to be Satoshi, or someone else was claiming to be Satoshi.
Which might be the brilliance.
Yeah.
So where can people find out more about you? Where can they find out about your blog and read more? What's a good address for everyone to look at?
All right. Organofcourty.blogspot.com. Spelt the same way as the organ of Courty, which is probably not something that anyone knows how to spell. So that's not very handy to know, I guess.
Well, they can Google it.
They can Google it
by spelling it. Google will correct their spelling, though. Don't worry about it.
It probably will. Or you can go to Bitcoin Talk, where I spend a bit of time either discussing issues of religion, but mostly discussing things on the pools subboard of Bitcoin Talk. And you can find me there as well.
Excellent.
Thanks for so much for being on the show.
I had lots of fun. Thanks.
We would love to have you back at any time. And if you ever have anything important you want to say, and it's groundbreaking, call us. We like that kind of thing.
So what do you think about Oregon? That man is a great man. I really like him. I have a lot of respect. I don't think he has a lot of fun.
Like in life or like in Bitcoin?
Just in life. I think he's like,
I kind of got the same impression.
I don't think he goes out much.
Yeah. I don't know how long you can hang at a Chris and Josh tour of South America. That's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, upside is I don't think he has any STDs. Not because he can't get women, but because, like, he's not seeing the same women you're seeing.
Well, with a name like Oregon, I mean, I would have assumed either one or the other, that he has a lot or none. So, yeah, that was interesting, dude. I knew nothing about that guy.
He probably dates high-class women.
You know,
unlike you. You know, you're like, how many teeth you got? All of them? I'm not taking you out to dinner.
No Red Lobster for you.
The only girls I've ever seen you date order soup. Because that's the only thing they get through the straw. They can't, like, chew.
Everyone's got something they're into. Yeah. Don't hate. Don't get salty on me.
I think I'm a little worried. I think you should date women with more teeth.
I'll think about it. I'm getting older.
You are getting older.
Well, if you like this episode, subscribe. We're available on iTunes and Stitcher. You can reach out to me on Twitter at DeRoseTech. A number of people have been reaching out to me on Twitter lately saying that they joined Twitter just to harp into debates with me online, and I appreciate
that. That's stupid.
No, it's wonderful. That's really cool. I see the guys show up and like, yeah, yeah, take that, scammer.
I just joined Twitter for this.
And yeah, if you want to talk to me on Telegram, I'm Brighton36. On Skype, Brighton36.
Don't talk to me.
And that's it for today, people.
This is John Seth, chunking up the dudes to the south. The mass has ended. Go in peace.